Thank you very much for that wonderful kirtan. This is part two of a series that started last week. As you can see, the title is Controlling Our Reactions. And we'll forward it here to the point at which we left off last week. There are five ways to control our reactions. When someone serves us, be understanding, not demanding. When someone disappoints us, be gentle and not judgmental. And the third principle we're going to talk about, the third of five, coming up right here, is when someone disagrees with you, let's see, how do we get this? When someone disagrees with you, be tender without surrendering. First thing we need to realize is that you can't please everybody in life. As soon as you please group A, group B is unhappy. As soon as you please group B, then group A is unhappy. And if you're in a leadership position, you have to have a thick skin, because you're just not going to make... Is it too loud or not loud enough? It's a little soft. Jacked it up a little bit. Doctor, I've eaten something that disagrees with me, and the stomach says, no, you haven't. You stood up at the meeting and disagreed with the boss. Well, I'll bet there was quite a backlash, and the guy's got the back of his shirt ripped off with all kinds of claw marks on there. How to be tender without surrender. How do you handle disagreeable people? People who irritate you, people who like to contradict you, people who like to get in arguments, people who like to quarrel with you. Anybody know people like that? They're just combative all the time, like they've got a chip on their shoulder. Nothing you say is acceptable to them. Arjuna was a little bit like that in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. Although Krishna was his friend, and he was fully aware that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, descended on the earth for the purpose of annihilating the miscreants and protecting the devotees, Parijanaya Sadhanam. Arjuna was fully aware of that, but he had a serious problem in the form of his friends and teachers and relatives being arrayed, ready for combat, opposite him. In order to achieve all those good things for which Krishna descended, Arjuna was going to have to make some unprecedented personal sacrifices. He was going to have to fight and kill those people with whom he had a bodily relationship. And he got a little bit feisty there. He got a little bit contentious. He got so much disagreeable, in fact, that he announced, imagine God's present and God says, Arjuna, I need you to fight to clear the way for righteousness and piety. I need you to remove the miscreants, just like a farmer removes the weeds before the good crop, the wanted, healthy, beneficial crop can grow. So Krishna says to Arjuna, I need you to remove the miscreants so that the way can be paved for righteousness. And Arjuna gets a little bit disagreeable. He says, how can I do this? I know that you're God. I know that it's prearranged. But I have an incapability of raising my arm in anger at Bhishma, for instance. Bhishma taught Arjuna much of what he had learned about martial arts. He said, I should be throwing flowers at Bhishma. In India, it's a custom. If someone's worthy of respect, you do pushpanjali. And that means you offer flowers. If it's Krishna, you do it 108 times. Each Om Krishnaya, Om Vasudevaya, Om Sanatana, Om Atmajaya Namaha. So he says, my arm, you know, when it goes to throw something, it wants to throw flowers. It doesn't want to throw arrows and spears and javelins. It wants to worship him and not kill him. So Arjuna needed Krishna to do this, or he wanted him. And Arjuna kind of digging in his heels, and he's being a little bit cantankerous here. And finally he says, Na jochna iti govinda, ukpatushnam bahubaha. He says, I will not fight. I will not follow your orders. So how does Krishna handle it? This is how most people handle it. There are three options. And you can see Krishna takes the best of the three. You can retreat in fear when someone is disagreeable or attacks you. You can attack in anger, or you can respond in love. Now, the Bhagavad Gita tells us that there are three modes of material nature. Three gunas. One of them is the mode of goodness, one of them is the mode of passion, and one of them is the mode of ignorance. Here it is said in the Bhagavad Gita by Srila Prabhupada, the living entity is conditioned by material nature of various types. One is happy, that's the mode of goodness. One is very active, and that's the mode of passion. Our modern civilization is a passionate mode, and especially city life is always going, 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 going. Very active. And another one is helpless. Another one is passive and lethargic and hallucinatory. All these types of psychological manifestations are causes of the living entity's condition, status, and nature. Now, if you're in the mode of ignorance, you might just not do anything. You might just let people push you over, you see. And your lethargy and passivity and being overwhelmed and paralyzed by the mode of ignorance might be mistaken for meekness, but it's really not meekness. Meekness means strength under control. If you're in the mode of ignorance, you just don't have any strength to control in the first place. You're just weak because of intoxication, hallucination, sleeping, all kinds of activities in the mode of tamagun. If you're in the mode of passion, you may just explode. You may just explode. This series is called How Not to Overreact. If you want to find out whether this applies to you, here are some questions that you can ask yourself. And the answer, if the answer is yes to any of these questions, then you need to hear this lecture. And not probably just once, but download it on your iPod and hear it several times. Ask yourself, do you regret the things you say in the heat of emotion? Do you regret some of the things that you say in the heat of emotion? Do you lash out at loved ones is another question you could ask. Do you often have to apologize to others for what you've said to them? Do you occasionally feel surprised and uncomfortable? You know, everybody in the room has stopped talking and they're kind of looking at the ceiling and looking away, anywhere but you. And do you feel like you've just stunk up the whole place by overreacting, you see? And no one's more surprised, did I say that? Did I really do that? Is everybody really, really turning away from me? Do you feel surprised at your own uncontrollable reactions? Do you assume the worst about people in situations? You automatically take a pessimistic point of view. And finally, do you withdraw within yourself when things get emotionally overwhelming? Do you have a pity party? Are you Mary Martyr? So these are all symptoms that we're overreacting. Now, those in the mode of passion, they're subject and prone to these kinds of explosions, verbal overkill. And they blow those who disagree with him just right away. Prabhupada says here, or Krishna is speaking to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita about the mode of goodness, which is called sattva-gun. The mode of passion is called rajagun. The mode of ignorance is called tamagun. Quote, O sinless one, the mode of goodness, being purer than the others, is illuminating and it frees one from all sinful reactions. In other words, if you don't react, you get free from reactions. If you learn not to overreact, then you get free from reactions. If you overreact, you create for yourself future samsara, future karma, future birth and death. So a key to not have to take repeated births and death, to not getting entangled in karma, to not being subject to reactions, is don't overreact in the first place. Learn how to react appropriately to the situation and in such a way as to benefit everyone concerned. Those situated in that mode become conditioned by a sense of happiness and knowledge. This is General Patton's. I don't know if he's an ideal archetypal person in the mode of goodness, but he wrote a book which is very popular called Patton's Principles for Managers Who Mean It. And his two principles are never fight a battle where winning doesn't make any difference and don't get into an argument over something that doesn't matter anyway. Now, when Krishna was on the planet, you see this picture here, and there's another version of it on the screen. Indra, the king of heaven, and I believe in that picture he's in the upper right-hand side, riding on his elephant, Aravata. So Indra, as well as Brahma and the various demigods in charge of universal affairs, they knew that Krishna was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, come to the planet to exhibit his pastimes. But nevertheless, they were a little territorial. Indra's been around for a few tens of thousands of years. Brahma also tested Krishna. He's been around for a few hundreds of thousands of years. And they're just like a little territorial, as is customary. And so Indra wanted to test out, who is this 7-year-old boy being worshipped as God, talked about in the scriptures? What would happen if I just pushed a little bit? What kind of a pushback would I get? He became curious that way, and especially he was provoked when the annual sacrifice for Indra, who is the god of rain, came around, and Krishna talked all the inhabitants of this rural village out of doing their annual sacrifice to the god of rain, Indra, and did it to the cows and to Govardhan Hill. And that was the spark that just set Indra off. And then he thought that who is this upstart Krishna? Who is this upstart? If he's God, let him prove it. And Indra invoked not just ordinary storm clouds, but the storm clouds that are usually invoked at the annihilation of the universe. These are storm clouds that are only brought in one time. and they're meant for the annihilation. So he called them and he said, go to Vrindavan and destroy it. And they came and they started pummeling the area with rain and it got cold. All the inhabitants were in danger. This was a tremendously provocative, aggressive act on the part of Indra. He was trying to kill Krishna and the cows and the cowherd boys and all those who were dear to him. He was trying to flood and drown them all. And Krishna, when he saw what Indra was up to, this aggressive, aggressive action, Krishna's first thought was, I should destroy Indra and all of his kingdom. I should destroy Indra's kingdom. I should destroy the kingdom of heaven, which is within this material world. But then his second thought, because he's God and he has this panoramic view, he sees the big picture, he thought, but it's so insignificant. The planet of Indra, the kingdom of Indra, from which we get rains and which is called the heaven, he said, it's so insignificant. It's not worth the trouble to destroy it. He says, I'm going to do something a lot more interesting, a lot more fun. What we're hearing here is that he didn't overreact. He kept within himself. He kept his cool. He was in the mode of goodness. He was happy. And he thought, how can we have fun with this? Instead of just overreacting and exploding, you know, and blowing Indra out of the heavens and all, what can I do that'll just be fun, you see, that artists will paint picture of thousands of years later? So he looked at Govardhan Hill, and he got an idea, and he got his little finger, the pinky of his left hand, in under the hill, and he lifted this hill. Now, the hill was much bigger 5,000 years ago. The hill shrinks every year. But the hill as it is now, after having shrunk steadily for 5,000 years, it's 24 kilometers to walk around it. If you do Govardhan Parikram, it's 24 kilometers. It takes about half a day to walk around it. So this was the hill in a bigger form that Krishna lifted with the pinky of his left hand, and he held it just like a child holds a mushroom. As easily as a child holds a mushroom. Mushroom doesn't weigh anything. Krishna held this big hill. And all his cowherd boyfriends and all, you can see they're aghast. They're aghast. Krishna, you know, they're trying to help him hold the hill, and Krishna's just smiling. He calls all the cows and all the inhabitants, come in under the hill where it'll be warm and dry, and you'll be comfortable and you'll be safe from the inundation. So for 7 days, the rains and the storms went on. And Krishna held the hill up for 7 days. And after 7 days, Indra realized, I overreacted. Whoops. Whoops. Krishna's like the sun, and my power is like a firefly. In fact, whatever power I have to rule over the heavens in this world, that's coming from Krishna. You see? And I've really overstepped my bounds now. So he said, stop, you know, stop raining, go away. And he hastened down on earth with his elephant, and he bowed down before Krishna, and he told the elephant, bathe Krishna, you know, he asked the elephant, take up some nice fragrant waters and give a nice mist to Krishna. After all, he's been holding a mountain for 7 days. So give a nice mist to him, refresh him. And meanwhile, Indra offered his prayers. Now, Krishna didn't overreact when Indra mounted this aggressive campaign against him. Indra overreacted to what he perceived was a slight. But Krishna did not react in kind. Isn't our instinct that when someone does something to us, we want to get back at them? Isn't that our instinct? Tit for tat, it's almost like a reflexive action. But Krishna, being situated in the highest mode of pure transcendental goodness, didn't feel that irresistible impulse that we're all subject to being in the modes of ignorance and passion and mundane goodness. He was able to keep his cool and calm and do something extraordinarily wonderful, which we're celebrating here thousands and thousands of years later. Now it's interesting, when Indra came down, Indra went from one extreme to the other extreme. He said, "Who is this Krishna?" Like that. And then all of a sudden he's like a cowering, you know, sycophant, you know, "Krishna, I'm so sorry, Krishna." And he's giving all these prayers in Sanskrit and glorifying Krishna and begging him. And he's going on and on. And Krishna's just like nothing. Indra's looking for a sign, some little smile or something that he's forgiven. And he's going on and on. He's getting more and more nervous. He can't really tell what Krishna thinks of his apology. He doesn't really know if after he finishes, Krishna's going to thump him anyway or what. But what has happened here is Krishna is not overreacting either way. He's not meeting aggression with aggression. He's not meeting fawning abject servitude. He's not indicating that he's particularly pleased with that. He's in the middle somewhere. He's self-contained. And that's why throughout Indra's prayer, he didn't actually know if his prayers were pleasing the Lord or displeasing the Lord. And at the end, he finally ran out of things to say, and he's waiting there. And Krishna just says, "Okay, go home and behave yourself." And he still doesn't know what Krishna thought about the whole incident. He just knows he lucked out. Let's just agree to disagree. Most of the problems of the world come from people wanting everyone to be like them. You want everyone to be of your race, of your gender, your economic status. You want them to worship like you. They want to believe exactly your concept of God, follow your scriptures. And because we don't accept that God is a person who loves variety, we're trying to make everything over in our own mold. And that's just not wanted. Those who appreciate and celebrate all the diversity and variety are much more knowledgeable about the nature of God than those who are uptight and denominational and sectarian. This is meekness. You know, meekness sometimes is taken for weakness, but we're trying to get the point across in this series of shows that meekness is not weakness. Meekness is not weakness. It's learning to disagree agreeably. Someone disagrees with you, be tender, but don't surrender. Don't surrender. Walk hand in hand without seeing eye to eye. It's said that in a marriage, when two people agree about everything, at least one of them isn't necessary. So of the three options when someone disagrees with you, one option is you can be a passive, you can be a doormat, you can let people run all over you, you can withdraw and say, "Go ahead and have your own way," or you can fight them tooth and nail, blow up, explode, get angry, fight back, be sarcastic, or you can respond in love, just as Krishna responded to Indra. Meekness is not weakness. Meekness means that your power is under control. That's the meaning of meekness. Prabhupada says here, the Lord's servant, remember, we represent, we are made in God's image, and as we go about our lives, it's proper and fitting for us to reflect the qualities of God in our own lives. He's created us in His image, and where He Himself has shown meekness in the face of the provocation of Indra, we should also learn to show meekness. That doesn't mean that we make ourselves a doormat. It doesn't mean that we overreact. It means that we're tender without surrender. And we use the incident to instruct the transgressor. So we can all learn from it and it becomes a win-win situation. Prabhupada said, the Lord's servant who's representing the Lord, he shouldn't just react like everybody else. You know, I have this Pedro. And you know, we're good buddies and he keys on me and I do all kinds of good things. I give him special walnuts and I give him peanuts and I take him out and I swing him. I give him exercise. Sometimes I keep him by my bedside at night. So there isn't any question that I have his best interests at heart. But if I'm petting him or something and I just pull a feather the wrong way, he goes, "Ah!" and he just like bites me. After 5 years, you know, he'll still like make marks on me, you know. Some people come, "Does he bite?" I say, "Yeah." Yeah, got all the scars to prove it, like that. See what I'm saying? But that's animal life. Just to react like that instinctively means that you're not in control of your destiny. You're simply allowing other people and other situations to control you. So you will leave, you will exit this life the same way you came in ignorance. A child doesn't know anything about self-control. Right now they're talking loudly and running around, and that's fine when they're children. They're not expected to have a lot of self-control. But when you come to the exit door, you're supposed to have learned how to be above the pushings and pullings that the animals cannot transcend. Otherwise, your life is pretty much a failure. So the Lord's servant must not quarrel. Those who oppose him, he must not react, but gently instruct them in the hope that Krishna will give them a change of heart. And that's key, to know that God is within everyone's heart. And it's not me that's convincing them. But if I respond in a way that's pleasing to Krishna, then Krishna may show mercy on them as well. One time a great saint named Haridas Thakur was living in a cave, chanting 300,000 names of Krishna every day. And people wanted to go see him, but cohabiting the cave with Haridas Thakur was this huge poisonous cobra. And people were afraid to go into the cave. So when Haridas Thakur learned this, he said, okay, I'll leave the cave, I'll find somewhere else to chant. As soon as within his heart, as soon as he communicated that to his followers, the snake got some extraordinary message from its own heart. And before Haridas Thakur, the devotee of the Lord, could be inconvenienced to relocate, the snake left. As if to say, you stay, I'll go. So this is the power of the Lord within everyone's heart. You say someone can never be changed. Someone is incorrigible. You know, you all have these people at school, at work, and everyone else just rolls their eyes. And if they see them coming down the hall, they'll duck off or turn around or find somebody to use. Everyone's written this person off. You know, but as a servant of the Lord and knowing that the Lord is within everyone's heart, we need to respond to disagreeable people with tenderness and without surrender, because the Lord can always and will work wonders from within the heart of the living being. This is called, in the Bhagavad Gita, one who sees inaction in action and action in inaction is intelligent among men, and he is in the transcendental position, although engaged in all sorts of activities. Who sees action in inaction. In other words, if you don't react, if someone acts towards you and you don't react, you see, that is actually action on the transcendental platform. You're not reacting, but you're remembering the Lord and the Lord within everyone's heart, and you're acting to please the Lord. You're acting to bring about your own liberation, your own mukti, your own salvation, because you're not reacting. So not acting is actually acting towards your own best interest and the interest of the other person. And acting is not acting. If you react to a disagreeable word or a provocation, that is inaction, because you've done nothing to elevate that person. You've done nothing to elevate yourself. That is inaction. And that's why we're here in this material world. That's why we have material bodies. That's why we endure birth, death, disease, and old age. Because we're reacting, and therefore we're doing nothing to bring about our salvation or to please the Lord. Here, the action and inaction is further defined. Action means to do something of which the result is enjoyed by the doer. As devotees, everything we do is as a servant of the Lord. It is as a servant of the Lord. The Lord wants temples all over the world. He wants lessons to be taught from the Bhagavad Gita. He wants his deity form to be worshipped. He wants the distribution of prasadam. So he wants all that. We're not doing it. He wants it. He's doing it. He's within the heart. And we're just the instruments. So we're not doing it for ourselves. We're doing it for the Lord. So that means that in terms of material bondage, we are not active. We're not, by our activities, we're not being karmically trussed up and bound up by the modes of material nature. Now, if someone who is fruitive worker working for money and house and mortgage and defines themselves in terms of all the fruits of their activities. And they look at a devotee, don't have a bank balance, don't have necessarily a health plan, don't even have a plan for their own future. They see those persons as being foolish and naive and inactive. The things that they think are important, we're indifferent to them. The things that we think are important, they're indifferent to them. They see us as spoiling our life because we're not in material acquisition. We're interested in ultimate liberation. All duties, all goals are meant for ultimate liberation, not for some temporary benefit. And we see them as wasting their time. You get a car. What are you going to do with the car? I'm going to drive it. And then what? Well, the car will get old. Well, what are you going to do then? I'll sell it. What are you going to do? I'll get another car. What are you going to do? I'm going to drive it. And then what are you going to do then? Well, it'll get old, and I'll sell it, and I'll get another car. Oh, okay. Okay. Wait, you just took birth. You just took a body as a man or a female or black or white or American, Christian or Hindu or Jew. What are you going to do? Well, I'm going to work hard, and I'm going to get a place to live, a fancy place to live, transportation. I'm going to have a family, support my family. Okay. And then what do you do? Well, I'm going to get old, you know, and then I'm going to play golf, and then I'm going to die, you see. Well, then what are you going to do? Oh, I'll take birth again, and I'll start it all over again. And everything that I earn, all my bank balance, all my assets that I earned in my last life, that went to the kids. Kids get to take it all, then you get to take another birth, and then you start working again to raise a family, to make money, to put assets in the bank, and you get old, and you retire, and you die, and you leave it all behind, and then you get to do it again, and again, and again, and again. Fun, huh? Fun, huh? So that's called inaction. Because you're just doing this. There's no action there. Nothing going on. Same old, same old, same old, same old, same old. But those who are working as instruments of the Lord are actually purifying themselves of fruit of acts, karmic reactions, and in the very near future get to go back home, back to the spiritual world. So when someone disagrees with you, be tender without surrender. And we'll do one more of these and leave the last one in the summation for next week. Again, the first one and two, which we talked about last week, when someone serves you, be understanding, not demanding. When someone disappoints you, be gentle, not judgmental. And when someone disagrees with you, be tender without surrender. The fourth principle out of five principles is that when someone corrects you, be teachable, not unreachable. Meek people, who we said before, are actually strong people with their reactions under control, are eager to learn. Meek people do not pretend they know it all. Here's what Brigham Young said. All truth is for the salvation of the children of men, for the benefit and learning, for their furtherance in the principles of divine knowledge. And divine knowledge is any matter-of-fact truth, and all truth pertains to divinity. In other words, he's not saying Mormonism is this dogma or doctrine, or is within these parameters, or is within these walls, or that anyone has a franchise, or that anyone has it in their pocket. And if they think that, they're not Mormons, according to Brigham Young. Brigham Young says, Mormonism embraces all truths wherever found in all the works of God and man that are visible or invisible to the mortal eye. So if I've said anything that's true, if I've said that when you should be understanding, not demanding, gentle and not judgmental, tender without surrender, if that's actually true and that's the way the Lord wants you to comport yourself, then you can say that's Mormonism. That's Mormonism. According to the man that settled Mormonism here in Utah Valley. Now, if you're quick to listen and slow to speak, then you'll be slow to anger. We have two ears and one mouth. You've all heard this before. We should be twice as eager to listen and half as eager to speak. Unfortunately, most of us are twice, at least twice, if not 50 times, more eager to speak and very, very uninspired to listen. But if you're slow to listen and you're quick to speak, then you'll be an angry person. Be careful of people that have all the answers. Those are the people that you need to be afraid of. Those are the people that are dangerous. The path to salvation is not through speaking when you're not based in knowledge. First, we need to hear. Krishna says over and over and over and over again in the Bhagavad Gita, the the path, the process for transcendence, the process for filling our heart with the mode of goodness and achieving the kind of satisfaction that comes from that and learning how to be proactive in our life, it begins with hearing. But not just hearing anything. Not just hearing anything. Not just hearing from any know-it-all or loudmouth. But hearing from the Supreme Personality Himself, who says this: one can get liberation by seriously discharging devotional service unto me and hearing for a long time about me or from me. I've been hearing for 40 years. 40 years ago, I took my initiation from my guru, Srila Prabhupada, and the process that he gave me for learning how to control my reactions and free me from samsara consisted principally in hearing. We have a class on the Srimad Bhagavatam every morning at 6 o'clock. Then, after doing our day's duties, we gather together in the evening at 6 o'clock. Public is also invited. And we have a class on the Bhagavad Gita. And we also chant, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hari Hari, Hari Rama, Rama Rama, Hari Hari. We learn to hear the name of God. We learn to develop a taste for hearing about God's holy name. And that counteracts our normal taste for hearing about our own name. It is said the sweetest sound in any language is the sound of a person's name. You know, if someone says your name, you just get so, oh my God, I'm so satisfied with that. See what I'm saying? So we need to transfer that tendency to the tendency of hearing God's name. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that when I hear the names of Krishna sung or chanted, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hari Hari, Hari Ram, Hari Ram, 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 tears flow from my eyes like torrents of rain. My hair stands on end and I get goosebumps all over my body. Are we that eager to hear about God? Because when you're so eager to hear about God and indifferent to hear about your own so-called glories, you are a candidate for entering into the kingdom of God. It is a question of transferring one's attention from one's own self to that of the Supreme Lord. By thus executing one's prescribed duties, there will be no reaction and one will be free from the contamination of matter. So that means that when you hear about Krishna, and right now, as you sit here, you are not only accruing karma, not only are you not creating bonds, ropes for your future enslavement in the material modes of material nature, but by hearing about Krishna, those ropes are relaxing and being released. They're being slashed by hearing about Krishna. But unfortunately, one sitting is not going to do it. Krishna says you have to hear for a long time. You ever get those antibiotics? And the doctor cautions you, don't discontinue those antibiotics until the course is done. So if you start chanting, Hare Krishna, reading, you're going to start feeling really good about yourself. But the trick is, don't discontinue the course, you see. It's a lifelong course, and at the end of it, the door to liberation is thrown open. As I said, I've been following for about 40 years. It's the priority of our life. When we get up in the morning, there's all kinds of things on our to-do list. There's all kinds of pressing things. There's all kinds of deadlines. But the most important things are not the most urgent things. The most important things in your life are the things that you need to do every day of your life, in order to purify our hearts, release us from the bonds of karma, and bring about immortal life in the kingdom of God. There will be no reaction, and one will be freed from the contamination of matter. Now we can learn from each other. Prabhupada, in 1965, he established the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And the principle is that alone, we're not very strong. Alone, we can't read Bhagavad Gita, we can't do any of these things with consistency, most of us. But together, we're strong. A single page of a phone book can rip very easily, but the whole phone book, you cannot rip it very easily. We're made to fit together. We're not made to be lone rangers. We're not made to chant in isolation or to read in isolation. The whole idea of the solitary hermit, I mean, whatever that may be for him, that's not for us. We are made to fit together. All of us have strengths and weaknesses. Where you're weak, someone else is strong. Where you're strong, someone else is weak. We all work together. I don't sing very nicely. Jai Krishna sings beautifully. Hanuman sings beautifully. They're needed here. They're needed here. I may speak a little better than someone else. But that's whatever God created you to do. Arti is a fantastic cook, you see. We're put here with our various strengths and weaknesses to fit together and to realize that we need to go back to the spiritual world together. It's not a lone endeavor. We're all ignorant. We need to recognize it. We're just ignorant on different subjects. Nobody knows everything. And we need each other. Counsel in the heart of man is like a deep well, but the man of understanding will draw it out. Did you know you can learn from your enemies? Did you know that? That when someone disagrees with you or criticizes you or tries to correct you, you know, oftentimes people that are the most abrasive, that are most unpleasant, they're often very discerning. They're very discerning. If you can get past their manner and their nature and their unpleasantness and get to the basis, the kernel of what they're saying, it's usually right on. Have you ever noticed that? They have the power of discernment, they just don't know how to use it. They misuse it. But if you know how to take that kernel of truth and apply it, you'll get, in many cases, more good advice from your enemies than you will from your friends. I always go to the blogs. You know, people come, and I figure, you know, every once or twice a month, someone who's been to the service, you know, they'll do a blog. And so I do a Google search, Krishna Temple and all like that. And one week, I found a blog from a BYU student. And she said, I didn't want to take off my shoes at the door because it didn't look clean. So I asked the door, I said, is the floor clean? They said, yeah, it's clean. We wash it, we mop it. But we realized because of its rough surface and the grouting, over the years, in the grout and all, it got picked up dirt. And the marble didn't look as white and shiny and pristine as it did certainly when we installed it 10 years. So we got together, it was going to cost $2,000 to clean it. They have to have a special steam thing with a truck and all that. So we clean it, and my God, we realize that it really, really looks good now. Tell me what you think downstairs. So because we're here every day and we're seeing it, we didn't even notice it particularly. It wasn't really clean, but it didn't look that clean. And someone walks in the door, God sent them. You know, sometimes someone, because of a certain gift of discernment they have, they'll walk in the door and they'll immediately notice something that needs to be done that those of us who are every day just missed. Because we're not manufactured that way. I read some of the blogs too, and a lot of the neighbors and friends, they come in and they go through the tour and they're, very good, wonderful, wonderful. And then they'll go and they'll say, idol worship. Pagans. They're nice pagans. So I learned from this, you know, that there's this and then there's this, you see. So I address this now. I do a tour and that'll be a subject for another day. But I explain completely how this is the furthest thing from idol worship. And I got that cue from people that were slightly inimical, not enemies, but they expressed what they were really thinking on the internet, and I benefited from it. So we learn from our enemies. Our biggest critics can help us out the most unintentionally. They may mean to hurt you, but Krishna can use that criticism to teach you and make you more sensitive in a certain area. Here's the great story about the churning of the ocean with Mount Meru, and the demigods and the demons are on one side. And normally they are enemies. They are die-hard enemies. The demigods, including Indra and Brahma, and then the demons with Bali, Maharaj and all. But in this case, they made a truce. They worked together to get the pot of Amrita. And as a result, that's another story, but the demigods became very much empowered to protect righteousness and goodness in the universe. Being a good listener cannot be overemphasized. Here are some practical points. Sit quietly. Pay attention. Don't interrupt. Wait for your turn to talk and ask questions. See, we go to Venice Beach every year for the Rath Yatra Festival. I see this guy. He is the greatest listener. Doesn't he? He's just sitting there with all kinds of people come up and sit next to this guy and they tell him their problems because they know he's in a mood, his head is cocked, he looks like and most importantly, he's going to let you finish what you have to say. He's not going to interrupt, you know. I sit down and talk to him every year. I look forward to laying some things out for this guy that no one else will sit still and listen to me long enough for. And in the Bhagavad Gita it says, if you perfect this art of hearing from the supreme authority, even if you're the most sinful of sinners, because the hearing process is so powerful, it's like the sun. When the sun shines on a urinal, because it's so powerful, the sun does not get contaminated. The opposite, and it takes time, that's why I'm emphasizing, this should be a lifelong part of your schedule. It takes time, but in due course of time, not only does the sun not become contaminated by the urinal, but the urinal itself will become antiseptic and prophylactic because of the exposure to the sun. So it doesn't matter someone says, well, you don't know what I've done. You don't know my past. I could never become purified. I could never be eligible for salvation. The problem is, we don't need to know who you are because we're all disqualified. We all fall short of the mark. All we need to know is who God is and how powerful He is. And the fact of the matter is, you cannot expose yourself to the Lord in the form of His holy name and not get purified. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. Or any bona fide name of God from any tradition. God is non-different than His name. All of His mercy, grace, potencies are contained within His name. He gives us literally hundreds of thousands of names so we can associate with Him in the form of His holy name. And in this way, on that raft of knowledge, on that boat of knowledge which is created by the repetitive hearing of the names of the Lord and the discussing of His philosophy, that will carry us over an ocean of sin. There's no purifier on earth equal to the hearing process. And once more, and this I think will be our last slide for today, and we'll take up the last issue and summarize next week. In the spiritualization of energy, Prabhupada writes, he who sees inaction in action and action in inaction, he is wise among men, he is a yogi, and he has performed all action. He whose undertakings are all free from desires and self-will, and whose works are consumed in the fire of knowledge, he, by the wise, is called a sage. Satisfied with what comes to him without any effort on his part, rising above the pairs of opposites, free from envy, and even-minded in success and failure, though acting, he is not bound. And so thus goes the path of liberation. We'll stop there, and next week we'll begin with the fifth and last principle of controlling our reactions, that when someone hurts you, be an actor and not a reactor.